timing is a huge factor. Even if we were a year earlier, I don't think we'd have done it. We had to ride the wave. Our record was 0 to 250k in one day. The first couple of deals we did were 500 quid.
What was the valuation?
180 million when we listed. Took all the responsibility on ourselves and yeah, business, you completely like destroyed me. I was caught up in France at the terror attacks, heard the bombs go off, and I think I had PTSD from that. What I was not doing was solving these problems.
Yeah.
And then what I was doing was drinking to try and cope. You know, my mum said to me, I don't recognise you as a person.
Wow.
And how bad I'd become, you know. And I had one opportunity to do something about it.
What did Stephen think of all this drinking?
Yeah. So I got really good at not getting caught, basically.
What does he have that has allowed the Diver CEO to become this absolute Goliath of the show?
Really sweats the small stuff, you know, finite margins, improvements, you know. It's relentless. Like, the guy is beyond anything I've ever seen anyone. He will be like the UK, like Elon Musk.
Today, I talked to Dominic McGregor, who co-founded Social Chain with his business partner, Stephen Bartlett. This is a deep dive into building a multi nine-figure agency and his descent into alcoholism and now living a sober life. Okay, so I've been really looking forward to this conversation. For those watching that don't know, my background is I have a marketing agency, and by any measure, it's been successful. But it's nothing in comparison to what you guys did with Social Chain, and that's where I want to start. So I want to start at the beginning of that. How did that first happen? Obviously, you and Stephen Bartlett created it. How did that first come about?
Yeah, I mean, when I was 19 years old, I had no idea what an agency was, you know, let alone what marketing was. So I was at university, you know, doing sports science. I pretty much failed my first year of business as well. We had to do like Edinburgh, you had to do a different course alongside it because to make up credits. So I was terrible at business, but got drunk one day, great night out, woke up the next day, no toilet paper, and was like, oh, you know what I need to do right now? I need to start a Twitter account. Just the logical thing to do, you know. I'm not going to go to the shop and buy some toilet paper. I'm going to tell the world I've got no toilet paper.
Yeah.
So I logged into Twitter, started up an account called Student Problems and tweeted about not having any toilet paper.
Okay.
And you know what? I thought it was hilarious. I was like, oh my God, look at me go. And this is in 2013. So yeah, Twitter is just coming about, you know. You've got like Stephen Fry, Rihanna, Justin Bieber, and you're like connecting people in the world together. And it was this really kind of amazing thing. And I absolutely loved it. So I was getting quite obsessive with it. So Student Problems was born from that. And it was just basically following my life at university with no kind of premise of where this was going to go in the future. And then I met Steve, and Steve had a website, which was basically Gumtree for students. Mm. And he'd tried everything from a marketing perspective to get it out there. So flyers, billboards, you know, handing out leaflets, everything that you used to do in 2013, kind of guerrilla marketing, student ambassadors, all that stuff. And I think, you know, we had a bit of success. People came to it, people signed up. But we sat there together when we first got together and we said, oh, let's just post it on Student Problems. At this point, Student Problems has got about 25,000 followers.
Okay. So you're getting some traction with it.
Yeah, good traction at this point. Yeah. So, you know, that's how Steve saw it. Steve saw it on Twitter and was like, this is students, let's get together.
Mm.
And then the minute we pressed a link, 300 people went straight to the website. And that was like the aha moment where it was like, oh my God, people do what you say. If you click a link on here, they go to a website. And that was like the unlock moment in the business where it was like, okay, this is powerful. I still had no idea what marketing was. So the theory was then, you know, the more eyeballs we could build on social media, the more people we could send to our own website. That was the logic. So my responsibility was to build out as many eyeballs as I could on social, starting new pages, growing existing pages, and managed to get to a point where we had about 3 or 4 million students across Facebook and Twitter, just by starting pages.
So how long did that take? That's a huge amount of people.
Yeah, that took not long. Like, I remember one day we started a new page and it got 250,000 followers in a day.
What?
Yeah.
Why is that? Because you'd worked out what to post.
Yeah, it was early mover.
Yeah,
you know,
okay.
There's a lot of space at this point. People aren't running Facebook pages. You know, there's a very, very early to the game. So when you went on Facebook then, it was just like mates commenting on walls. It wasn't people sharing content. So this was really new for social media. So we created like a space on social media, which was comedy, funny pages for students.
Yeah.
And you can imagine everyone's at university, very, very early. You're sharing those pages very quickly and then the growth happened. So our record was 0 to 250k in one day.
that's
and like, you couldn't do that now.
No.
Jurgen Klopp launched his the other day and he got 1.5 million. So he beat us.
But I mean,
he's Jurgen Klopp.
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, we went around building more infantry, and we realized that not only was it valuable for our website at the time, it was valuable for other people. But what we realized ultimately was that the social media pages were more valuable than a website. Because if we had 4 million eyeballs on social media, but we could only send 2,000, 3,000 people at a time to the website, long-term, people are going to want to be posted on social media pages. So our theory was, and you know, this is where I think, you know, timing and fortune play a lot of roles in starting businesses in general, was that these social media websites, Facebook and Twitter, are going to stick and they're going to be the here. If you think previously you had MySpace, Bebo, Friends Reunited, those, we all use them. I don't know, you know, you must have had Bebo and MySpace.
Yeah.
But they didn't stick.
No.
So there wasn't, you know, when it came to marketing and it came to businesses, they'd seen these flurry of activities of social media, and there was never anything where it's like strategically valuable to a business. So the timing piece was really fortunate because these social media websites stuck.
Yeah.
So what we basically had done is proven that we understand how to grow accounts on social media. So what happens over the next couple of years is businesses start accounts on social media.
Yeah.
So who do they go to? You know, who can sit there and say, I've got a case study of how to grow an account on social media?
Yeah.
No one else has, because no one else has done it. So we had this massive first mover advantage where we could walk into a big business and say, hey, we know how to grow on social media. Here's our examples. So because we'd built out over the next couple of years, students, gaming, food, fitness, fashion accounts.
Okay.
We covered so many sectors that when it came to speaking to any client in that area, we could say, not only can we post you on our pages,
right,
but we can also embed into your strategy and help you navigate where social media is going in the next couple of years.
So it's like almost a combination of what you could probably refer to as like influencer marketing now, because those pages might not have been around a person, but they occupied the same space. You could do the similar sort of thing.
Yep.
And then also doing client work. Before you started doing work for businesses, were you monetizing those at all?
So we dabbled a little bit in AdSense, a bit of article work, which, you know, was okay.
It doesn't pay well, does it?
Doesn't pay well, no, and it's long burn. I think the difference, you know, so there's other publishers in the space that I really respect. So you've got obviously the Lad Bible Group and what they've built. They were around at the similar time.
Right.
If I go onto my Facebook messages, I'm actually in a Facebook group with Solly, who's the founder of Lad Bible. He's a good friend of mine now. And the founders are Unilad. And we were all in a Facebook group at the same time.
Of course, yeah.
Because we all kind of started them around the same time. And the media route that they went down in terms of growing eyeballs and stuff on the brand, that was a huge route. But for some reason, we deterred directly initially to clients. So we started to speak to other businesses about how we could help them. And, you know, marketing is services. So you actually ended up becoming a service business first rather than a media business. So we had all these eyeballs and we had all these things, but really what we enjoyed doing and what we found ourselves doing naturally was helping clients solve problems. And those problems started off with, can you get some more eyeballs on a discount code for our students? Could you tell people about Spotify 50% off? All these things which were other brands' messages. And then as we kind of grew, they became much more strategic challenges. So we built a front of facing into clients straight away.
So when that first started, were businesses reaching out to you or were you sort of going out to them? How did that work?
So the truth was, you know, we had, you know, as any business, you've got to get off the ground at some point. So I remember specifically, you know, Steve, me and Ash, who were kind of were the three doing it, we were sat there in a bar in Manchester and we were like, okay, well, let's go and find 100 businesses each that need to speak to students.
Okay.
We made a game of it, yeah? We couldn't have anyone that was the same.
Right. Okay.
So like it had to be 300 original contacts.
Yeah.
So I can't, you know, I'm sitting there in like an Excel spreadsheet up and trying to find businesses that were interested in reaching students. So many different routes we did. So we sent out 300 emails. That was our kind of like go-to-market strategy of working with the social chain. And I think from that, we got our first three clients, which was great.
So you had a 1% conversion rate on cold email.
Yeah. It was pretty good back at the time. We thought we were incredible.
It'd be difficult to do now, that's for sure.
Honestly, it was great. And then we did some great campaigns for those guys. And then what kind of happened from that was some conversations sparked with other people, which were more long-term. But what we basically realized was over going and trying to email these people, actually, the most powerful thing to do would be to stand in front of them and tell them what we do. Mm-hmm. So we went to a lot of conferences and we did a lot of kind of events. And what we'd do at events is Steve would be on stage telling them about what we're doing. At the start of the talk, we would get a hashtag.
Right.
So something like, you'll know you're British when.
Okay. Yeah.
Just something like that, generic one, or favorite quotes from movies, just something like that. And we would make it trend while he's on stage.
Really?
So my job was...
So you could do that based on the power of the accounts that you had.
So my job when he was on stage was to make something trend.
Oh, wow.
So he could sit there and say, we can make anything the most talked about thing in the UK in less than 20 minutes.
Wow, so that's super powerful.
Yeah, super powerful, yeah.
And then the businesses sat there alike.
You know, we did that in front of like really big clients. You know, we did that at a conference, and off the back of that conference, we got Disney, we got Microsoft, we got Hungry House, if you remember Hungry House, 20th Century Fox, all these big businesses. Like, you can get all these people in the UK to talk about something while I'm sat there watching you. And it literally blew people's minds. So that became a party trick. We did that a couple of times. We then actually did it. Someone from BuzzFeed came down and was like, literally, this is what I did. I know I'm getting filmed, so I can show you. Sat down, you know, he's a very faceless, emotional, unless emotional guy.
Yeah, yeah.
Got his phone out.
Right.
And was like, you guys say you can make anything the most talked about thing in 20 minutes. Literally opens his phone, goes on his clock, goes on his stopwatch, and goes, go on then. And then literally, I'm sat there looking at it going, this guy's coming here to do a hit job to show we can't do things.
Right.
And he just sat there. So we were like, oh my God, we panicked. And then we did the same thing we'd do at a conference. But we had to turn around the creative straight away, the idea straight away. And it took, like, in the BuzzFeed article still out there, and it took us like 22 minutes to get something the most talked about thing on Twitter.
Really?
Like that. And
just from, because obviously imagine with the conferences, you've got it prepared.
Yeah, yeah.
So he's all loaded in 20 minutes from scratch.
Yeah, he put the stuff down and that. He came into our office, there was like eight of us, and we didn't know what he was wanted, and he just basically did that, and we were like, oh.
I bet.
The funny, coming back to what we said at the start, I still don't know at that point what an agency was.
Right, okay.
I didn't really know, you know, we didn't really understand wider marketing. We were kids who were running social media accounts.
Yeah.
So like we were just doing fun stuff and we didn't really know who we were. And we'd speak to people and they'd be like, oh, so you're like an agency.
Yeah, okay.
I'm like, yeah, I guess you could say that.
I guess we are.
So, and what we tried to do initially was like, look, we believe we could help solve your challenges or your problems or your things through social media. So, you know, someone would give us a trailer and say, we want this to blow up and people to talk about it. And we would do that. So we naturally fell into services through that route. And then, yeah, it was when we kind of rode the wave and the popularity of social media that we started to look at, okay, what should our service proposition be? How do we scale a client team? And where do you think the world of social media is going to go in the future? And I guess what role do we play in that social media landscape?
Because I guess at that point, you could have gone down the route that you did go down, agency, or you could have effectively just remained a media company and sold advertising, influencer-based posts and things.
Exactly.
Which is more like what a Lad Bible kind of is.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I imagine it was much more lucrative at the time to take the client money to go down that alternative route.
I mean, this is the great schism in my life. The problem that... In hindsight, you know, the problem with agency business is people. You know, you've got to find the right people, you've got to find the right number, you know, to scale that, you need more people to be able to do more things. Media, you've got a bit more exposure in terms of reach and options in that world. So, I think the going headfirst into the client world built us very differently to a lot of people, because you understand businesses in a slightly different way, and the challenges you're faced with, you know, by the end of the kind of social change journey, Coke Zero kind of said to us, we need more people to drink Coke Zero. And that was like the level of like challenge we were facing.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is amazing. That is like a project. Like, well, where do you even begin on that?
Yeah.
So...
The vague instructions gives you so much room for creativity and working
exactly,
out.
Exactly. Yeah. But, you know, there is no lie around it, but scaling that business was ridiculously difficult with people, with problems, with clients and... problems and issues that constantly happen in the agency world.
Yeah.
was very, very tough.
Yeah. I'll get back to the podcast in a second. Before I do, I just want to very quickly ask a big favor, and that's to subscribe or follow on whatever audio platform you're listening to this on, and please leave a review. The more reviews we get and the better our rating is, the more people will find about this podcast, which helps us get bigger and better and more interesting guests and further grows the community. You'd really help us out if you could take a few seconds just to do that. Let's get back to the show. Agencies, there will be people watching this, the starting their agency journey. Agencies are hard.
They're so hard. And like, you know, we'll go into it later, but the impact it had on me personally was massive.
Yes.
Yeah. And yeah, you know, if you asked me what the challenge, if you sat me down at 20 years old and said, this is the challenge you're going to go into in the agency world, I'd have been like, no.
I'll just keep doing the media.
Yeah.
We'll sell advertising. And we know how to get these audiences. We can monetize it that way.
Exactly.
Yeah. Might have been an easier life. Okay, so it sounds like you went in at the beginning working with big clients. You didn't start with, you know, the small business down the road.
Yeah, I mean, out of those 300, the three that came back to us, one of them is a publicly listed company now.
Wow.
They were in their infancy. They were a Manchester-based business, but they're in their infancy, and they worked with us for a long time. You know, they still worked for us maybe like probably until we left.
Wow.
So, yeah, you know, and then some of the first deals we got was, let's say, the Spotify deal. That was through a third party, but they were working with Spotify. So again, Spotify weren't the biggest business in the world at that point. They, yeah. You know, they were a little bit niche. You know,
it
hadn't taken off 10 years ago, but they were definitely on the trajectory which they have achieved now. So, you know, we always experienced, I think from day one, we always experienced rig, I guess, with those companies comes a little more rigor and professionalization of what you're doing.
Mm.
So I remember the level of reporting we had to deliver for Spotify was ridiculously high. So we always learned this service approach, I guess,
okay.
of like assuring that the client has what they need, the reporting is in place, the strategy was there, the deck was presented in a way which was the right way. You know, I spoke to an agency owner the other day and I was like, oh, have you got your sales deck? It's like, I don't have one.
Right.
I'm like, what do you mean you don't have a sales deck? What do you mean you don't have a sales deck? Like, oh, all our business has come from word of mouth. I'm like, that's great.
It'd still convert better if you had something to present.
Well, you know, that's, yeah. I don't know if this is a post-COVID world or whatever, but show me your sales deck and credit deck. You know, we were obsessive over like our creds, our case studies, reporting.
Yeah.
You know, we always saw every single kind of like post-campaign wrap-up as an ability to upsell. Yeah. And I don't know, you know, the behavior we learned, felt like we were learning best practice from day one in the servicing world. Mm. And we became obsessive over the clients and communication and how things are positioned. And I think it was, you know, maybe because like a lot of the time the work we were doing, and we were hearing this quite a lot from people back in the day, was we don't have a budget for social media.
Mm.
So we had to fight for budget rather than now where like, you know, if someone does influencer marketing, you're competing against others for why your influencer marketing is better than others. We were competing against like telling people why social media was the future. So we put a lot of effort into explaining that as a start from day one. It was like, why social media is going to be better than TV, print, why you should be putting budget to it. And those were the conversations we were having really early, trying to convince people that the actual social media ecosystem was somewhere that was right to invest.
Mm.
Which did a couple of things. A, it got us straight to like senior people because you're talking about budget allocations.
Yeah.
But it just, like I said before, it meant us that we had to open the door professionally and, you know, sometimes try and act a little bit older than we were. You know?
Yes. I think anyone who started a business, like I started my agency when I was 23. I think anyone who started a business young has had to do that.
Yeah.
To be like, right, I need to pretend to be about 30 right now.
But there's a perfect, but the other side of it was that because social media was so new and that this happens so rarely, we could walk into a room at 20 years old and be experts.
Yes.
You can imagine in the financial world, a 20-year-old walking in and being like, I'm an expert in derivatives, that, you know, the old people are going to go, no, you're not.
Yeah.
But because of social media and it being so young and new, we could walk in and say, we're experts.
Yeah.
And that that helped, you know, there was a balance. We were young, we know we're young, but let's just try and be a little bit older and a little bit more maturer than they think we are. But they're buying into us because social media is down with kids.
I always thought that was such an advantage because when I first started, I was offering Facebook advertising services primarily, and this would have been 2016 and I was 23.
Yeah.
And it was a similar thing. It was like, no, there's no 20-year-old veteran here.
Yeah, yeah.
It hasn't been around long enough for anyone to pull that to pull that card.
But what was interesting was that a lot of people very early were put off because they'd been burnt previously.
Yeah, okay.
So there was a lot of early moving cowboys
in the space. Yeah.
Someone, a client told me, someone charged them $2,000 to set up a Facebook page.
Right, okay.
Which was set, like, it takes like, what, 20 seconds to do that?
Yeah.
And I was like, someone charged, I was like, sorry.
Not even put a load of stuff on it, just literally.
I was like, oh my goodness. Like, you know, bear in mind, we never charged anyone to set up a page. We never did anything like that.
Yeah.
It, you know, it was like, say, Wild West. And when new things happen, that's what happens sometimes. And we had this little secret weapon behind us that we built these communities. So we know social media. So yeah, that really, I guess, going back to what you said about who we worked with, it straight away put us in the shop window for big clients who were innovative and looking at new options constantly, like a Spotify, for example.
And I imagine that with the businesses, if they haven't run anything on social before, and then you're doing it for them and it works really well early on, you then have the potential for big budgets, like you mentioned, and being able to upsell.
Yeah, and look, the numbers early on work better than they do now.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's like, say, the reason we could grow an account so quickly is because it was less busy.
Yep.
So there was a first mover advantage for brands as well. You know, probably the best example there for me is ASOS.
Right, okay.
They were so early on social media, they kind of became a social media following. I think they got like 5 million people on Twitter, for example.
Wow.
Which is very rare.
You'd really struggle to do that in their industry now.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So like that became a really kind of, people that were there early, invested early, did really well. And obviously, you know, we know there's a lot of businesses that have been built from that kind of model of influencer marketing. You know, Gymshark, for example, that's how their entire business was built.
Yeah.
So there was a massive, 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 massive first mover advantage. So what was actually happening was the results were great. So people will come back for more and more and more. And then look, what happens then is the platform start to change things. You introduce paid, you've got to try to navigate in the wider world of influencer marketing as reach was restricted at that point. You know, I remember sitting there one day and all the Facebook news about the algorithm restricting reach of organic channels. And people were like, what does this mean? We're like, well, it's now going to start being pay to play and you're not going to reach all your audiences. So there was huge changes going on, you know, and Snapchat would come, Instagram would release stories. And it became a world of ever-changing nature. Yeah. And our responsibility, because we were running our own channels, was to keep up with that change, but then also keep clients at the forefront.
And it's impressive that you did, because I've seen a number of agencies, they work something out that works really well, like you guys did. You had this ability to grow these Facebook pages, Twitter accounts organically really quickly, but that changed. That became much more difficult. But that didn't end the company, because I've seen some people where they find something out like that and then 18 months later they can't get a client.
I think it's a mindset piece. You know, we someone said to us very early, like, what happens if Twitter disappears tomorrow? And I said, well, we don't have a business.
Mm.
And that was something in the back of our mind. You said previously the social media pages, like websites of Bebo and MySpace, were always in our mind that at some point they're going to go.
Yeah.
So we always knew we had to go quick, go diverse, look at what's new, because there was one day, for example, you might not even remember this. And if anyone doesn't remember this and actually remembers this, please message me. So there's a social media page that popped up called Elo, social media website.
So.
No, you won't remember it. It basically got loads of funding. It's supposed to be the next big thing, ELLO. And we spent probably like a morning just securing handles on there. Because just in case.
Yeah, yeah.
Just in case it became a big thing. So we would have all the handles, you know, like all the and we spent a long time doing that, and then it didn't become a thing.
Yeah. Okay.
So that was our mindset. So we saw that, we popped in, we got handles, we set up pages, put up a bit of content, didn't work. Probably spent a lot of time on it.
Yeah.
Pulled back. And then, you know, what happens a couple of years later when TikTok comes, we do the same thing.
Mm.
So it was a philosophy. Mm. That philosophy was more valuable than anything, because it was just a point of like, the world is ever changing, the platforms are ever changing, we need to be nimble and agile. We can then sell it into clients if we're the first in these places.
So as the like organic reach that you get on Facebook, for example, massively decreased, at that point, did you more or less transition to like a full service social agency?
Yeah, I think you could probably draw a map between like the reach. You know, we were acquiring more pages. Our reach was doing pretty well, to be honest, from an organic perspective. There was probably a real sweet point in time where a video came out and video was getting loads of reach. If you were doing like a word only post or a picture, it would die. Mm. So we transitioned to video. Video became a big thing. Live streams became a big thing. So it was always something which was
you were always able to maintain organic reach.
Yeah, yeah, there was always something which was boosting the algorithm, you know, and I think there was you know, obviously Facebook will never say it, but you'd have company pages which were selling products which would be ding, but we're doing funny videos and funny videos, you know.
Yeah. They can still now, you know. Exactly. People think of Facebook as a place you can't get organic reach, but you will see the videos with 20 million views.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And, you know, so... So yeah, we were always kind of navigating in what would happen is new features would get bigger reach. So that was then something we'd turn to clients. So
yeah.
As new features and new products came out on the platforms, it's like video, our services expanded because we could then sell video because we were doing it for ourselves. So there was this kind of like, yeah, growth of services, growth of products, maturing of social as well. You know, when we first started, we were kind of like, well, you know, what are we, a social media agency or what? And then you start to get influencer marketing agencies coming out who focus on influencer marketing.
Yeah.
You started to get like Facebook specific agencies. You started to get in-house teams, paid agencies who would start looking at the kind of their area of the social media landscape. And we kind of had a conversation at that point where what we want to be known for is a social media strategy.
Okay.
So we kind of, I guess what we tried to do is elevate ourselves as the person to go to for social media.
Yeah, yeah.
So if you've got a big business or a big challenge and you want to you want to address it, we can do it. And then underneath that, we'd do influencer marketing, we'd do paid, we'd do content creation. But the idea was that we would be the go-to for strategy.
That's interesting. I guess, particularly when you're working with larger businesses at that time, a lot of them didn't even know what they needed.
Yeah.
So they would struggle to reach out to a specific agency that focuses on LinkedIn or because they just don't even know where they need to go, what they need to start with.
Exactly. So it was always for us a consultative sale of like, okay, well, we can help you solve your business challenges through social. Because we believe that and it's still possible to do that. So, you know, we dealt with big multinationals who had international pages across every single platform, who had massive resources on running a random account in Japan from...
Yeah.
And all this kind of thing about, you know, consolidation of accounts, you know, actually developing content production strategies, tone of voices, what platforms to use and why, influencers, do who, what, when, where, how events and... It can link into social and starting to see things through social first lens was kind of the view, which, you know, I think the world's moved to now a little bit. And you know, we were talking about the social first concept really, really early. And, you know, we were starting campaigns where it was maybe TV or print advertising or whatever with bigger agencies. And then you'd have one little section at the end on social media, how this lives on social media. And it'd be the worst hashtag anyone's ever created in their lives. And you're like, this isn't going to work. And you know what's happened now is that I've seen some of these pictures from big agencies. Now it's like, hey, this is what we're going to do on social media, and this is how it relates to TV, print, and billboard.
Yeah.
And you're like, okay, the world's changed.
It's completely changed.
And, you know, and coming back to the first thing I said about how we did it, you can't look past timing.
Yeah, you couldn't do that same thing again.
It started now. It's, you know, there's no good news story. So for us, like, I look back at it, and same for a lot of entrepreneurs, is timing is a huge factor. Even if we were a year earlier, I don't think we'd have done it.
Really?
You know, something might have happened, we might have got frustrated, we might have gone down a different
route.
So,
wow.
Being in the right place in the right time for us was like a really impactful piece of fortune.
Yeah, I think I had that to some extent because I've made a name for myself within Facebook ads specifically. And I started creating content in like 2016. So I had that like 2016 massive increase in popularity in advertising as people were transitioning away from organic from a few years ago. And it was like, it was really good timing for me that I definitely got lucky with. What were some of the budgets that these clients had that you're working with?
You start off scratching service and whatever anyone can allocate money to. You know, first couple of years was like, oh, we can get some budget from here, get some budget from here. But at the end of it, you know, you sat in the discussions with big companies where they're allocating millions of pounds to social media every year. So like the role of becoming a strategic company was to like, okay, have influence and control over the spend.
Yeah.
And we'd see it every single financial year where we'd say, look, you know, the big corporates, they get budgets allocated, So we'd work with the social media team or the marketing team to get more for social. And every year it was increasing. And then what would happen is then in like 2017, 2018, they'd start to get paid budgets. You know, you saw that. And they start to get influencer budgets.
Yeah.
So now, you know, when I look at big corporates when they're doing budgeting planning, there's just lines for influencers. There's lines for paid ads. There's lines for social content. We never had that.
Yeah.
We created those lines.
Yeah.
So it completely varied, completely changed. It'd be the speed at which companies go at. But you know, the first couple of deals we did were, £500.
Okay, so I'll get back to my conversation with Dominic in a second. Before I do, a couple of things I want to quickly let you know about. Obviously, we're talking a lot about marketing agencies here. I own a marketing agency, love conversations like this and going through all the detail. And if you're a marketer, business owner watching this, there are a couple of ways in which I could potentially help you. So firstly, I have a mentorship program. So if you want to learn how to get great results with Facebook ads, Instagram ads, etc., you can go ahead and check that out. Secondly, we have an agency that runs, creates, manages, and optimizes ad campaigns for our clients. So if you're a business owner, and I'd love to have an agency that can get me great results, we can do that for you. Again, there'll be a link in the video description below. So if you want to click on either of those, you can go through, book a free call with one of my team members to find out more, and hopefully we get a chance to work together. Right, okay, so you did start with small deals.
Those free deals, yeah, honestly, we start like...
That's almost nice to hear.
Beg, borrow, and steal. You know, the first time we made over £1,000, we decided to book a flight to Thailand. Okay. And we went to Thailand literally with no money. You know, I was living off £500 a month. That was my life. So we didn't walk into.
But these were still bigger companies that could have spent a lot more. You're not working with, you know, the hairdresser.
Yeah, but we're begging, borrowing, and stealing to get a budget from anywhere. Yeah, you know, I think we were maybe like, what, it was February time. So budgets are set.
Yeah.
Okay. And marketing directors really can't go outside what the proposed spend. Signed off.
All of that stuff.
Built everything already. You know, a lot of times in big businesses, the budget's spent by this time of the year, May time, because they're all committed it.
Yeah.
So you've got to then try and move things around and for a test, and was it going to be worth it? Social media, like, it's just unknown. So yeah, we didn't walk into like big budgets. We kind of had to scrap around to start off with.
Yeah, I remember. I think my first ever client was, I had a cake shop in Canada.
Get a free product.
No. And I think I charged them £100 a month to run their ads for them and stuff like that. And it's just like, ugh. You look back at that. Well, you had to learn, right?
But yeah, you do. And I think that, again, the whole point of service business is you start somewhere and you scale up.
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't sound like you played around in those small businesses for very long. And I think a lot of people start marketing agencies think, I'll work with the micro one-person businesses now and I'll be able to work my way up. Have you seen that as being possible?
Look, we had a lot of success early on with apps.
Okay.
There was a lot of apps came to us. And again, come back to timing piece, there was a lot of money going into apps at that point.
Yeah.
From an investment perspective. So, I think there is. The service business is based on service and case studies.
Mm.
Really, you sell your case studies, don't you? So if you have a really good case study on what you deliver for someone, that helps you get your next piece of business.
Yeah.
And if you service it really well, then you can grow within that client. So, and then what happens is a couple of people do really well in jobs, they go elsewhere and they want to work with people they know.
Yeah.
So it's about relationships, it's about service, it's about delivery. And if you do those things really well in a service business, you'll get more work. What I think it will be difficult for is someone to go and work with big clients from day one.
Mm, yeah.
Unless they're operating in a new world or a new frontier. So if you are the go-to people in AI of helping businesses navigate AI and implement AI in their business, you'll be working with big companies right now.
Yes.
So like, you know, so social media was a frontier. The current frontier is AI.
Yeah.
Three, four years ago, it was blockchain.
Yeah.
So if you're at these frontiers and you're the best in these frontiers, you will be delivering for big clients because big clients will need this. And there will be not as many competitors there.
Mm.
You know what it's like with paid ads now. It's like, you're not going to walk in and deliver for a big client day one unless you've built up a rapport and case study and track record. But if you're operating somewhere new, big clients need new. So yeah, I think that it's still possible, but not in the old marketing world. It would have to be in a new frontier.
Yeah, that's interesting. Because I've seen a lot of agencies, they start with small businesses and have the idea of, I'm going to work with, you know, the big brands, and then they sort of almost end up building a business that serves small, medium-sized businesses, and they can never really get out of that.
If I was to start an agency now again, I'd look for like 6 clients, 25 people, keep it at that.
And just that be that.
And go really deep into the clients.
So high quality.
High quality. Obviously, this is idyllic because one client leaves, you've lost 15% of your business,
which is terrifying.
Which is terrifying, but you know, not going over 10 clients and being selective who you work with, having a great team of people, and the ideal situation. Look, so take someone like a Diageo. You work with Diageo Group,
yeah.
So you've got all different brands, but you've got one client at the end of the day. That would be my ideal situation of like how to operate now. I wouldn't, at one point we did some analysis. We had 140 clients in a year. that's a signing a deal every day for a day.
Yeah.
It's a lot of clients.
Yeah.
So, I've got scars from service business. I'm not going to go into service business again.
That was going to be a question. If you had to start all over again tomorrow, no money, but you knew what you knew, would you
in
start
any
a marketing
sector?
Agency?
No, not a chance. dog walking business. Honestly, dog walking business. No, I had this conversation with someone the other day. I said, look, the service marketing world, every founder is a product founder.
Right.
So every single founder I come across now from investing and VC is a product led.
Right.
So they understand their product.
Yeah.
Be that like a technical solution around integrations or be it a coffee shop guy who loves coffee.
Yeah.
They all understand the product. What you've got with marketing is you understand the product, which is universally required.
Okay.
Because everyone needs marketing.
Yeah.
So because you're a product person, you understand marketing, you can speak to our founders in a language that they can understand. So the most powerful founders, I think, are ones that understand marketing, distribution, and their own product and whatever the new product is, because you can get it out there.
Okay.
So that's why you see probably a lot of people who are in marketing agencies go on and start other businesses because they know what to do.
Yeah.
And the other stuff they can figure out. So I think agency owners have got a great advantage because they understand marketing, they understand content. You know, your podcast, for example, has been born from you understanding content. So that gives you a different view on life. So if I was going to do something next, well, I'm obviously doing what I'm doing next, but if I was to start from zero and lose everything I've got right now, I've been driven by passion and stuff like that. So yeah, probably. Someone asked me this the other day, and this is going to sound crazy. I was like, oh, I'm really interested in jet washing.
Okay.
So like, but there's
just
a lot.
Really satisfying.
Really satisfying, yeah. But I think you can do it. I think you can do. I don't know why. It's something I developed in later age, but I think there's a really good opportunity to look at like commoditizing some of the services that are still in cash around like house detailing and stuff like that, where like window cleaning, that kind of stuff. Like I've not seen that solved yet.
Yeah. And if you understand marketing, you have a much larger competitive advantage in that sort of industry than you do in, say, the marketing industry, where everyone else knows about marketing as well.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So I think there's going to be a really big business, which, you know, like TaskRabbit or something like that, which does all the house jobs out on the external. You know, I still pay my window cleaner £25 in cash. Don't have any cash lying around. So
you got any in the cupboard sort of thing.
I know. I love jet washing, so I'll start doing it.
What headcount did you get to with Social Chain?
So across the entire business, we've got over 750 people. That included like Germany, some investments. A lot of people. But like the central agency services got to about 250. The media got to about 100. And then you've got like finance team, we had a tech team in Bangkok. So by the time you get past like 150, 200 people, it's like you start divisionalizing people.
Yeah.
And then you know, sometimes I never dealt with any people in Bangkok, for example.
Yeah. And I mean, and did you bring anyone on board early on who had experience in building out what is a really big team, or are you guys just trying to work it out as you go?
Well, I think this comes to kind of like the personal problems as well, because the truth we didn't. You know, our belief was that we did social media, so we're just going to have to hire people on social media.
Okay.
Which at the time was young kids.
Yeah, yeah.
We didn't think of ourselves as an agency, didn't think of ourselves as, you know, we didn't think that hiring someone who's got experience in marketing would help us. So we went ridiculously broad on like structure wise, didn't bring anyone senior in, took all the responsibility on ourselves, and business completely like destroyed me. Yeah. So like
the stress of that.
You know, I remember people getting mortgages and people getting their first cars and thinking, oh my God, like we've got to be responsible for this. And then you start working with bigger clients, and it's great working with bigger clients, you know. But suddenly you go from people who've got apps in London paying you in advance to big clients who are paying you in 90 days.
Yeah.
So like the chain, you know, and even though when 90 days comes, sometimes they still don't pay you.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's been my next point.
Like,
and they will pay you when they want.
They will pay you when they want. So like that whole transition of like scaling the team to deliver work that we were winning and the money not coming in from the work we were winning for a long time created real like tension points in me. And, I'm 20, 22 years old, 21 years old at this point, and I can't cope with this.
Yeah,
I've gone from like a year and a half ago, sat on a beach in Thailand, like drinking margaritas and being like, life is fantastic. Yeah. So yeah, there's nothing that can prepare you for that rate of growth. That not only you,
that quickly from that to that. That
you've point. You've got to become. You know, it's like when you're in the business, you're the leader of the business. You've got, you know, the people that in the business look for you for guidance in professionally, but also personally in their own lives. You deal with their problems as well. That comes into work. You've got to deal with clients' problems. You've got to deal with, like, you start to get, I mean, we got our first legal letter about from the ASA around what we're doing. And like all these things, when you've got a really unsolid foundation, knock you. And that's where I was. I was getting slapped left, right, and center. You know, something would happen every single day, be it a little problem, but a little niggle. And what I was not doing was solving these problems. Mm. They were just piling up, you know, it was kind of almost like a little bit of paralysis.
Yeah.
And then what I was doing was drinking to try and cope with these problems that were happening. And I was also drinking when we had great days and we were winning stuff. But what the truth of the matter is no matter how drunk you get on a night out, you're not going to win another contract.
Yeah.
Or you're not going to solve your cash flow issues.
Yeah.
But if you get ridiculously drunk, you're going to create more problems for yourself, be it personally or professionally. So that's what I was doing. I was drinking to forget about the problems at work, drinking to celebrate the great stuff at work, but in doing so was actually making my mental health worse.
Yeah.
I was doing like stupid stuff, like I fell over one night and broke my ankle coming home. I was, you know, upsetting friends, family, doing stupid stuff there, which was then making my entire life worse. Mm. So because all I was doing was working and that life was work, the two things were so closely linked. So me destroying my own personal life and myself was having a massive impact on getting things done in the business. And those two things just kept piling up and piling up and piling up and piling up. And couldn't cope. Didn't know what the problem was, firstly, and didn't know how to solve it. So was just then drinking more to forget about everything I'm feeling.
Now that you look back at that time, what should you have done instead?
I don't think there's anything I could have done.
Okay.
I don't think there's anything different I could have done.
Okay.
It was a real having to figure it out yourself. You have to run through the wall to figure out it hurts. And I could have been sat here and I could have failed to stop drinking and relapsed and lost everything. And I could have said to you then that I needed to stop drinking. But I probably had one shot at getting myself right, because the business is still going really fast.
Yeah.
I can't take time out of the company to figure myself out. I probably had one shot of stopping drinking and proving that to the team that, you know, who started to lose respect for me, that I was a different person, I was a better person.
Okay.
To this girl I was seeing at the time, who was sick of me, you know, messing up the relationship, that I was right for her and that, you know, we're going to work out. Mm-hmm. To business partner Steven, to my investors, that I can handle this.
Yeah.
And I had one shot. I had one shot at, you know, basically what happened is I've been back so far into a corner that I'd lied and I'd done that and that. And then I was confronted on the matter for the first time, you know. It wasn't like there'd been previous sit downs, and this was the first time there was a real sit down and like something needs to change now. And I had one shot to prove to everyone in my life, my parents, you know, my mum said to me, I don't recognize you as a person.
Wow.
And how bad I'd become, you know, got really short, snappy, angry. You know, and there was like these micro things that happened throughout the way. But there was one sat down once and said, this needs to stop, it needs to be changed. And I had one opportunity to do something about it. I don't think I'd got a second chance. I don't think I'd have been able, you know, take the girl I was seeing at the time. She caught me texting another girl when I was drunk. Right. Nothing like bad, but they say, no, are you out tonight? That kind of stuff. Yeah. I'm now married to her.
Okay.
Like, not the girl I was texting, the girl that told me off, just to clarify that. But I didn't have another second chance of her.
Yeah, okay.
And in the company, you know, I mentally wanted to run away from all the problems. And I think if I kept on drinking, I remember thinking, I've got to choose a life of alcohol or the business.
Really?
And it felt like a big choice, you know, when you're in that way. It felt like a really big choice. Like, I'm never going to drink again, or I'm going to run this business. And I was like, oh, I could just have a couple of drinks, have no stress, get a bit of money now and sail off to sunset. But I chose a business. So It was the worst period of my life, but I'm thankful I went through it.
Yeah. Do you think if you'd had more business experience, you would have not needed to drink in the first place? Like, I'm imagining a scenario where you hire a experienced finance director and operations manager, and they take a lot of that stress that you were managing off your plate. Or do you think you'd have ended up drinking anyway?
I believe it would have come anyway.
Okay.
I believe it could have come later. It, you know, I could have, I would probably have been a 45-year-old slowly deteriorating my life.
Right.
And there was a point when I was going to have a wake-up call. And, you know, my relationship with alcohol when I was younger was like, I remember in second year of university, I was like, I never missed a night out.
Okay.
And I wasn't addicted, probably was addicted, but I had no problems in my life. The biggest problem in my life at that point was like, you know, probably not being picked for the first team university and playing for the second team university at football. Yeah. That was my big problem. Like, I was like, oh God, that's, you know, or I had to get up for a 3 p.m. lecture and deciding whether I go to the lecture or not. You know, I took Fleetwood Town from League Two to the Champions League on FIFA. Like, I signed Luke Shaw, he did really when he was 16 years old, I remember that. I'm like, he's going to be a player when he grows up. I had Jamie Vardy up front, it was great. But like that's that level of stress and, you know, thinking to myself, I never missed a night out because I had the money because I worked all summer to be able to afford it.
Yeah.
Continued to work at university, worked at Vodka Rev so I could get free drinks. So I had no stress. And I probably was addicted. I probably was addicted to like going out, meeting people. You know, it was fun.
Yeah.
And like I'd never built within me the coping strategies to cope with real stress.
Yeah.
I'd never experienced it. So that was always going to come to me at some point, be it if I started the business or if I went into industry and got a job, it would come at some point. My inability to handle my emotions and stress was going to happen. So I'm actually like thankful it happened when I was so young. Like,
yeah.
I'm actually happy I went through it because it got it out of the way.
Yeah. And potentially less damage caused and
yeah.
both to you physically, but also to your relationships.
Yeah. And I think, you know, it's not to draw comparisons, but you see it, you know, you see it in some people now and, you know, maybe like sports stars who've got a really regimented life and then you let them free and then they mess up because they're now free from a regime and someone telling them what to do. You know, we ran our own business. We had no one telling us what to do. So I was in this kind of like resources were great. I could do whatever I wanted. No one was telling me what to do. I had no boss and I became a destruction. I needed to learn to manage myself. And it would have happened at some point. And I'm glad it happened when I was younger.
What did Stephen think of all this drinking? It must have concerned him.
When everything was in isolation, when, you know, I managed to get really good at like hanging out with different people, not to build up patterns.
Okay.
So I'd go back to York and see my friends in York and no one would hear from me from the work on Friday till Monday. No one knew what I was doing.
Right.
So like no one built up patterns. Like there was probably, you know, when I talked about these things that were happening, you know, I remember at Christmas, I went home to my parents and on Boxing Day, I got absolutely smashed. No, not Boxing Day, Christmas Eve, absolutely smashed at the pantomime we always go to and like fell asleep there and wet myself. And my mum had to take me home.
Wow.
At the pantomime. I'm 22 years old at this point. And like, I'm just like, there's videos of me like, and that's Christmas Eve.
Yeah.
And like no one else sees that. Steve doesn't see that.
Yeah, yeah.
So I've got really good at going around groups and not getting caught, basically. And I'd do a lot of drinking at home. And it would only when, and what I basically would do is I'd go out and I'd disappear from people. So I was doing damage to myself. And the only reason I got caught was because I was doing damage to other people on my last night I drank. So Georgie, who's my wife, who was a girl that I was upsetting, she worked at the company.
Right.
So everyone then found out. There was a video of me putting line in the WhatsApp chat from one of the people that was in work. So like Steve didn't know how bad it was getting because there was like a couple of examples. But I would hide it. I'd hide it from everyone. And I'd just get around different groups so people didn't pick up behavior patterns.
So it sounds like it all really came to head quite acutely. There was like one
real like rock bottom moment where like, you know, it went from me doing damage to myself and me, you know, ruining my life and like, you know, drinking a lot and missing opportunities and stuff. To, and you got to remember, I'm functioning, yeah.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Like, I'm function. I can yep. I can have 3 or 4 glasses of wine on a Tuesday and be up Monday, the next day, and bounce out of bed.
Yeah.
So I'm like functioning, and like, you got to remember, 22 years old, you bounce out of bed still, don't you?
Wow.
So I'm still
like a
young.
Lot of students. Yeah. Go out and drink, and still.
And like, there's an age part, yeah, where you know,
yeah.
where all of us are going out at weekends still, because it's what we do.
Yeah.
It's what young people do. So we're all yeah. going out. So it's not like, you know, if we got a 30-year-old mate now who's still doing that every single day,
yeah,
you see.
Yeah, yeah.
So
yeah.
The key thing to note is that we weren't emotionally intelligent enough as individuals to understand that this was a problem.
Mm.
I didn't still know it was a problem, but I was becoming quite secretive of my behavior. I was hiding bottles of wine at home, in my bedroom to carry on. And like, yeah, so... But when it became public and like I did things in public, which was very noticeable, then there was no running away.
So you said you needed to decide between drinking and the business.
Yeah.
And you chose the business.
Yeah.
When
business, parents, wife, you know, everything.
The lot.
The lot was like, you need to make a choice. You need to, it was basically like, you need to show us you're real.
Okay.
You need to, you know, the whole acronym of like, actions speak louder than words. I'm sorry, I'm apologizing, I won't do it again. The only like the best apology is change behavior. So the only way I could really apologize to people was to change my behavior. So like the reason I don't drink now, obviously I went through all that stuff and figured out what was wrong and stuff, but like I made a promise to these people are still in my life. Steve's my best man, my mum's my mum, my dad's my dad, my girlfriend at the time's my wife. So I promised all those people that I was going to be a better person.
And you actually told them, I'm done.
There's no way my wife would be with me if I was still drinking, because I'd have done something.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, I'd have done something, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
You get drunk, you do little gateway things, you know.
Yeah.
Something would happen. And, you know, I think I'm still on my last line with her, to be honest. So, you know, if I wanted to be serious as this person, I have to show change behavior rather than just empty words.
So what's the time frame on that? How long into social chain was this?
So this was 2016. We started the business properly in 2014. So this is like 2 years in, 18 months in.
So you're
really sort of, early.
Your descent into alcoholism was really fast.
In my book, I write like the day I'm on like what I call top of the slope. Yeah.
Yeah.
And this is the last day I really remember me being fun drunked on.
Right.
Where all my actions were just... great. And I was a fun drunk. I was a really fun person to be around.
Right.
And like, I tell a story about being in New York, being at a gig and like, just like high on life. Amazing. You know, I look at the pictures back at me then. I look good. I'm not like, I haven't got puffy cheeks and red faces and I don't look like someone who's been abused of alcohol. And we had loads of fun times together. And this is why, going back to the point around awareness of like, not things going wrong quickly, is like people still have the memory of me being a fun person to be around.
Yeah.
But like I then in that, that was in September 2015. The last day I drank was July 2016. So the last day
you drank, was that night you were talking about? Or did you drink again after that?
No, so the last night when I called it top of the slope was the last time I had fun drinking.
Yeah, no, sorry. Yeah. I more mean the night when you said you were hurting other people.
Yeah,
you
that was just, so that was
and
the
that
July.
Was the last night.
That was the last night I drank, yeah. So that was the July. So from September, end of September, it was the 30th or something, to July was the whole downhill slope.
So it's that time period.
That time period, yeah.
Which is, yeah, so the not long at all.
So the Christmas I mentioned, pantomime, that was the... Wow. December after September. So in the space of a couple of months, I became a wreck.
Wow. But
there's some things that happened there which accelerated it. So I was caught up in France at the terror attacks.
Oh, really?
Happened. So I was at the France-Germany game, heard the bombs go off, but walked into the city centre afterwards and had no phone charge. And I remember the first time having a physiological reaction.
Okay.
So like I remember like, be getting really fret up and really anxious and like panicking. But the funniest thing about that day was that was the same day we agreed our first investment.
Right.
So we had in that morning we had a £1 million investment into the bank account.
Right.
Landed in the bank account. That night I'm like knocking on a hotel in Paris trying to get a room because I'm scared there's fucking terrorists around the corner.
Bloody hell.
And I think that hit me a lot. I don't, I, you know, I remember bringing up in therapy and talking about it, and I think I had PTSD from that. The girl I was with at that point, she was very bad for me.
Okay.
She was a very toxic relationship. You know, I'm no way am I blaming her for what I went through, but she was imagine like a party girl, and you drink, your whole relationship with her is getting drunk.
Right. Yeah.
We broke up in the March, very toxic breakup. I went to Thailand to get away from her for stuff. Steve came out, we had a great time, but that impacted me as well. Low self-esteem after that. And then the whole time the business is bubbling away. So it was a really, really intense, a lot of things happening, which I just didn't know what to deal with. You know, we had the legal matter at that point. We had a guy from HMRC walking in demanding 75K there and then. All this stuff is happening. I'm like, oh my goodness. So it feels like a very short period of time, but a lot of things happened and it really rocked me. And come back to the point I said earlier, if you have not got a stable foundation of how you handle these things, they'll knock you over. Mm. And that's what happened.
How did you stop all of a sudden?
Purpose.
Okay.
You know, coming back to what I've just said there about the people I was impacting, some of my best mates in there and stuff, you know, parents saying they don't recognize you. The truth of the matter was I became someone I didn't like, and that wasn't me. I like to think I'm a nice person. I value the right things, but I saw someone in myself I didn't like. And I was all right hurting myself because that wasn't, people couldn't see that. And I was doing this damage to myself. I know I was, but I couldn't hurt other people. And when I did, I was really ashamed of myself. And then I had two options. I could carry on drinking, or I could lean into my business, my friends, my family, and show them that's not who I am. And they gave me the reason not to do it. And I think there's a little bit of being young still and not being conditioned enough to take a 45-year-old who's struggling with alcoholism at the moment.
Yeah.
There's 25 years of habitual drinking there.
They drink in this scenario and this scenario and this scenario. Yeah. It's hard to get out of these habits as much as it is the substance.
Yeah, and I'm young. I'm in a new city. I'm forming new habits. I'm running a business. I've got enough about me. I've got a new girlfriend. I've got enough about me that I'm not habitually there yet.
Yeah.
So even though I'm dependent on alcohol, my body, the first weekend I didn't drink, I had a phantom hangover.
Right.
My body was craving alcohol. The withdrawal symptoms were real. You know, the addiction was real. The dependency was real. But there's a difference between being 22 and being 45.
Your body can bounce back much
exactly.
faster.
And you've got your rest of your life ahead of you.
Yeah.
And you can think like that, and you can look at it like that. So the purpose and people was the main reason. And then, again, fortune plays a huge part of it. Is I'm there, I'm young. Mm. It's although I'm abusing myself and battering myself, I'm still only 22 years old.
Yeah. Has it been hard to not drink since?
Now it's really easy.
Yeah.
But the first year is avoidance. You've got to avoid situations. And then what happens is you start doing some of the firsts. So I do my first festival.
Okay.
I do my first football game. Yeah. I do my first pub crawl with my mates.
Right.
And then once you build up what you said there in terms of the emotional situations, and you can do things without having alcohol in it, then everything else is fine. Mm. You know, the first festival I went to was, about 9 months after I stopped drinking, I went to Coachella. And I'm there loving it, being sober.
So you still enjoyed it?
Honestly,
not everyone would they, had they enjoyed it previously drunk,
honestly,
going sober?
Honestly, it's one of the first times I kind of properly went out afterwards. And I remember being in one of these stages, and a little bit of dubstep came on, and I was two-stepping away. And I was like, I don't know what's going on to me. This just feels great. And it was this this euphoric feeling in my body of a little bit of joy and happiness, and I can do this without drinking. And that for me was a really big, the first things I did after not drinking were really big reminders that I don't need to drink.
Yeah.
So once you've done everything once, the next time you go and do it, you realize that you don't need alcohol, you know. And the last thing I held on to was the emotional relationship between a situation and a drink was a glass of champagne at my wedding. Everyone was you're not going to toast your wedding. And I was like, oh, maybe. But after a year, I was like, no, why would I do that?
Yeah.
Someone said, if you'd given over cocaine addictions and someone offered you a bag at your wedding, would you take it? I'm like, no. Then why would you take champagne?
Yeah.
It's good point. Can you imagine 10 years free of cocaine. No way. Like, come on.
Just do a quick line.
Just do a quick line. You know, that's the same premise of me doing a glass of champagne.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, that's where you can factor in conversations around culture and society and how they view alcohol versus other things. But
yeah,
when someone outlined like that, I was like, yeah, you know what? That's exactly the way to think about it.
Do you miss, you mentioned fun drunk Dom. Do you feel like you miss out on something because have him anymore?
He was so much fun. I got my Facebook memories. I'm like, oh, I did some cool stuff. Look, there's a sense that, you know, a couple of things I believe is like, does nothing fun happen after 1 a.m.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
I believe that.
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
So, and I've been out with enough of my friends now, enough people to see like that nothing fun happens after one. Mm. So if I'm out and I see my friends and I get to have a bit of fun, the stupid stuff that you do when you're younger, the crazy stories you got to tell are always a little bit stupid. So like, I've got enough of those stories to tell and I don't miss anything now. And I'm happy, you know, we talked about this previously. I've got a free weekend this weekend. I'm happy just chilling.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, I found so much more enjoyment in other things, that you don't have to be 1 a.m. in a club listening to Rihanna. Yeah. I don't know if Rihanna still makes music, does she? That's how often I've not been in a club at 1 a.m. right? It used to be Rihanna playing or Pitbull, and now I don't know what plays at 1 a.m.
You mentioned around alcohol and its place in society, and I've always found that very strange. I don't drink. I've had alcoholism in my family, so I've sort of never really drunk. I never had a problem with it. I might have a little something at a wedding or yep. on a stag do, but otherwise I don't drink anything. I've always found it very odd, and I imagine where alcohol sits in society, and I imagine that given what you've been through, you've probably reflected on that as well.
Mm.
What are your thoughts on how prevalent it is and how it seems to be used in every scenario, positive, negative, it's there?
Yeah, I mean, look, it's almost a protective characteristic, isn't it? You know, right. you can't come off the pubs in the UK because pubs are this cultural thing that the UK owns and operates and
yeah.
is a centre of our communities. I think it's bizarre. I think it's really bizarre that we give this protectionist status to a poison. Mm. And we defend it like we defend our rights to be able to do it no matter what. Mm. So look, you know, where this has been built from marketing around emotional moments. You know, there's no one who says that as soon as the weather gets nice, we should have an Aperol Spritz or a Pimm's.
Yeah.
Other than culture. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. You know, it really, if it gets really nice weather, we should be drinking more water because we get dehydrated. That's the scientific basis of it.
Something with electrolytes in it.
Exactly. Yeah. Get your salts in. Like, that's what we should be drinking. But what happens is you get this marketing and this emotional connections built between a Guinness and the Six Nations.
Yeah.
You know, so that's what culture builds is like the kind of, you should be doing, if you do X, you do Y. And then what happens is, look, the real belief I have around it and the home truth I have around it is the reason it's collectively protected is because no one wants to question it themselves. Mm. Everyone you ask will tell you they drink less than they actually do.
Mm.
And there's a whole, you know, when I tell someone I don't drink, I meet someone new, the first thing they'll come out with me is like, oh, well, I'm trying to cut down. Or they'll tell me they did Dry January. Or they'll tell me they're stopping. The conversation they have is about how they're trying to do less.
Okay.
And no one will put the hand up and say, I drink too much.
Yeah.
Because they'll always underestimate what they do. So there's a little bit of like power collectively of like, hey, don't come out of drinking.
Okay.
Just because you're on your high horse. So it seems to get protected by people. Because it's
no. So you feel like when you say that you don't drink, the person on the other side is feeling judged automatically?
Yes, yes, yes. Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, there's a sense that, you know, the real home truth, I really think, is that people use alcohol as their liquid confidence and their
yeah, yeah.
Dutch courage.
Yeah.
And when you tell someone you don't drink, their first thing they think about is like, what do you mean? you don't need to drink.
Yeah.
Neither do I. I'm trying not. But it's like, so what I talk about a lot is like, being sober gives you everything you think alcohol gives you.
Mm.
The confidence to be able to walk into a room and meet someone new, the ability to like not feel like you're being an idiot.
Yeah.
You know, that's a big part of it. Everything you think you get from one or two drinks, you get from being sober. And actually alcohol gives you, it's fake. Yeah. You know, you might think people aren't judging you because you've had a couple of drinks and you're relaxed, but you're not. And you're actually going to feel worse in the morning and you're going to think, oh my God, what did I say to so-and-so? Because No one has two drinks. You have four, five, six, and you carry on. So like, I can go to a networking event or to business, meet new people, know exactly what I'm going to say to them.
Yeah.
No, they're not judging me. Leave and rinse and repeat. I've done that hundreds of times since I've stopped drinking. Mm. And like, I have more confidence now. I feel more assured in myself. I never wake up the next day and go, oh my God, what did I say to so-and-so last night? So the kind of whole piece I said earlier about like the slowly declining things of drinking, the sobriety has the slowly declining positives where you build better relationships. You never mess up relationships because you're not saying stupid things and you don't do stupid stuff. So actually like, you know, the whole like idea of like 0.1% every single day, sobriety for me is that 0.1% where every single day I'm trading upwards mm-hmm. rather than trading downwards.
Yeah, it's an interesting way of looking at it. I think as well that you're saying about it, it's culture. One of the things that people often say to me when I tell them I don't drink is they can't get their head around the fact that I don't like it.
Yeah.
They always think I'm like making a sacrifice for health mm. reasons or whatever. They can't. Yeah. It's like, but it is a poison. And if you never really drink, as I've never done, everyone remembers being 14 or whatever yeah. and trying something, being like, that tastes awful. Yeah, and that is still where my taste buds are at because I never trained yeah. them to do so.
Or everyone thinks you've got a problem.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, all that. Yeah.
So like my message to people, like what I try to say to message is like, look, I was normal. I was a normal young lad and like my life changed very quickly.
Mm.
And like what I hadn't built was an emotional way to deal with stress. And we look at statistics now around Gen Z and like resilience and stuff. They haven't, like a lot of people haven't got resilience
yeah,
they've got.
Yeah.
So like when the earth starts to shift underneath your foot, as it does at times, as you get older and naturally things just happen,
mm.
shit just happens. We know that. If you're unable to deal with it and you've got unhealthy coping mechanisms, that's going to lead to a lot of problems. So like my message to a lot of young people is like, look, you don't understand the level of resilience you need to build to be able to cope with a lot of life. But you don't also realize the fact that you need to be able to have healthy coping mechanisms to be able to deal with things. And that actually these toxins, these poisons, either be it betting, be it smoking, be it alcohol, be it food, whatever, all these addictions that happen, if your life starts to rock and the world starts to rock and you haven't learned healthy coping mechanisms, you're at real risk of falling into one of them.
Do you have any other vices now?
Yeah, I like food. I like, but this is how I stopped drinking. Yeah, I started treating myself to nice food.
Okay.
So I like food. I try and limit myself with one coffee a day. I don't have more than one coffee a day. I don't really bet, but I like food. It's probably why everyone else who stops drinking gets like a six pack and a meal. I'm like, fuck, you know. I've lost the benefits of it. But I like food, you know. I still have stressful days, you know. I'm still doing running businesses, I'm still got stress yeah. and like I can't be like, I'm not perfect, no one's perfect, but I still need something. And you know,
okay,
I like pizza, like yes. It's the truth of the matter, like it's, you know, let's call it what it is.
Pizza is great.
Yeah, I love pizza. So yeah, so food is my big vice.
When you stopped drinking, what impact did that have on the business at times? So you said this was 2016. Did it make a big difference to what you were able to do?
It made a big difference what I could do and then what I could put to the business, the energy I had for the business. And like, look, you know, there was a great uptick over the next couple of years.
Yeah.
The business continued to grow from strength to strength. And obviously, if I wanted to really push it, I could be like, yeah, stop drinking, I'm a business today. But like, look, the building blocks are in place. You know,
you think it was going to do it? More or less anyway.
Yeah, look, everything we talked about previously was in place. But what it made us do, the big thing it made us do, coming back to the point on hires, was admit that we couldn't do it ourselves.
Mm.
So we had no senior management team at that point. And part of me getting well was having people around me to help me.
So just quickly, how many staff did you have without a management team?
We were probably about 40, 35, 40. We had a management team, but they were, you know, I think the oldest person we had the business, we had our first 30-year-old at that point.
Right, okay, yeah.
And we had a CFO who'd come in with the investors.
Yes,
so okay. we started to get an FD. And so we had people, but we probably didn't have enough operational people.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It was us holding our hands up and being like, okay, I think there was a period where Steve and I spent a lot of time talking about what we wanted to do and how we could help ourselves.
Mm.
And that was the decision to go and help people. You know, our management team at times, people at times were causing us problems rather than helping us.
Yeah, okay.
So it changed us talking about the problems in the business and our problems that having ourselves, led us to make different decisions, which okay. then helped the business grow. But again, coming back to your point about what I tell myself now is like, we had to realize these things.
Yeah, yeah.
We had to realize these things. Yeah. And thankfully, you know, my only wish is that we maybe realized them 6 months earlier, you know, so we could have done it quicker. But we had to go through the wall really, in business and in life. And the beautiful thing is that we had enough going on around us for us to be able to do it. We could learn and make mistakes, and we had great margins, we had great investors, we could make the mistakes and learn quickly. And I just wish I wouldn't change anything, but yeah, the falling flat on your face and going to like, you know, a psychologist around addiction, you have to break yourself down to pull yourself up again.
Okay.
So like, you know, the whole premise of AA is like, you know, you recreate who you are as a person, and you go back to like really kind of strong first principles. That was something that I did. And then that reflected in the business. And it was just, it opened the conversation around well-being. It opened the conversation around how we can make ourselves more resilient. You know, our founders just had burnout basically and destroyed himself, and look at him. That's not going to scale.
No.
How can we build a team? All these conversations then were off the back of us and me opening up about how shit my life was.
Okay.
So there's no like direct correlations of that, quiz of that, or that, but the whole thing was just like, the openness of us as founders together helped us solve problems. And before, we were just kind of being like young men who were like, I was thinking I can deal with this. It's not a problem. I don't want to admit I've got a weakness.
Which I imagine a lot of people fall into that.
100%. 100%.
How did you recruit? I mean, obviously it varied between roles, but you hired an enormous amount of people very quickly.
Yeah. Look, you know, there's a great part where we recruit by getting people who got social media experts. So people who run accounts, people who run social media. So we pulled them in quickly, build the base. These were the experts. All an agency is a group of people at the end of the day.
Yeah.
So we had the best people for social media. And then we then started to look at how we built a management team. As I said, retrospectively, I wish we did it the other way around, but
yeah,
you know, we learn.
You could hire the management team to then build out the team for you.
Exactly. And we basically did that in the long way. But the truth of the matter was, is that to become who we wanted to be in terms of the strategic perspective, is we needed people who understood wider marketing channels. So the management team were people who knew marketing, not social. So yes. While we were always looking for social people, we had tons of them, yeah. But we needed people who knew marketing. So we brought people in from big agencies who understood how to run accounts, but also how we could fit into the world of big marketing.
How did you divide, or maybe you didn't, but your responsibilities, let's say like between you and Steve as founders, like how did that work?
The same way you do it. Sometimes naturally these things fall into place.
Yeah, yeah.
And we're definitely contrasting complementary personalities.
Yeah.
So things just naturally fell into one person's lap.
Yeah. Okay.
I hear a lot about founder fallout now. It was just something where we just worked together as personalities.
Yeah. Okay.
It just happened.
If you have two people that have the same skill set, then difficult.
You fight. Yeah. So we just complement each other, and there was never anything that came in and be like, an email would come in, take the legal thing, and it'd be like, okay, I'll deal with that. Yeah. Something would come up and was, you know, Steve would do that. So it just happened naturally.
And you were always fine with your respective roles.
Yeah. Low egos.
Okay. The decision, before I get to that, why did you take investment if you had good margins? Which was going to be one of my questions.
Yeah, what your speed. Margins are like. Speed.
Yeah, okay. And you knew that at that time. That's really interesting.
Fear. Right. You know, come back to the fear of everything disappearing. Investment, de-risk, get further ahead. A little bit of ego, maybe.
To say, look, we raised a bunch of money.
We raised it, you know.
Yeah.
But the truth of the matter was we always felt like, you know, to come back to the guy telling us about Twitter disappearing. We knew we had to move quickly.
Yeah, okay.
Because we thought it was going to disappear. You know, there was, I think there might have been talks of banning stuff, like young people, like, so we there was this kind of, we had to ride the wave.
I know people that own TikTok agencies that are nervous about that now.
Yeah, so yeah,
these
yeah.
things happen.
So you have to ride the wave. Yeah. So it was speed.
Okay. And then fast forward a little, not that much time, but a bit of time, and the decision to exit the business. How did that come about? And were you both on the same page with that as well?
Yeah, so the page was completely aligned.
Okay.
Look, you know, I love the people of the business. COVID happened. You stop for the first time. You know, I remember going back and being like, oh, I've got to live with my girlfriend now because I never really saw her, really.
Right.
We just listed. Shares with public.
So how did that decision come about? How did that process happen?
Again, like we were always kind of interested in some kind of exit activity, and our chair had done two IPOs in Germany. So he helped us with that process.
Right.
So acquired a couple of companies, merged a couple of companies together, and then Social Chain became a bigger entity which was listed. Mm. He'd had previous experience doing that. So we're now running this kind of very different business from what we expected to be. We've got a management board of, you know, three of us from England and three of us from Germany. We're making strategic decisions and acquisitions. We're launching at new markets, launching events. Whole different kind of kettle of fish, really. You know, yeah. we've got quarterly targets to hit, which are real because it's what we're telling the market about it. And COVID happens, and there's a real reflection of what we want to do. I want to do next. And you know, COVID had a lot of negative impacts, but I think it slowed the world and made us ask big questions that we never asked before.
When the company went public, what was the valuation at the time?
180 million when we listed.
That's insane.
Euros, yeah, 180 million euros when we listed.
That's insane.
So then we merged, added a couple of companies on. So it's the public market, you get a lot of opportunity in the public markets. But yeah, we that was in the August 2019.
So at that point, financially, you and Steve, you're done. You're set for life.
The nice part about it is, like, once you've crystallized the shares in a public market, no one can do anything about it. You can't take them away.
Yeah.
So the first time they were real. Everything else before, it's spreadsheet numbers, you know?
Yeah.
So it's real at that point. And I think that was part of the decision, is like, no one can take this away from us now. We've done it. Like, let's go and start the next chapter.
Okay.
It was a realization moment, which, you know, when they put into your bank account and you can see on your bank account, you're like, oh my goodness, like, yeah, this is great. I don't need to be here anymore. It was kind of my mindset.
Had you taken much money out previously? Because I know obviously a lot of business owners struggle with, what do I take out versus what do I leave?
I remember the first deal, the first time we got investment, the shareholders wanted, the investors wanted to give us 20 grand each, and we said no. I don't know why we said no to that. Would have been great. Could have put it to test and be a billionaire now. Yeah, whatever. But no, we didn't. We didn't take money out on the way, and that was probably part of the decision making. That, you know, it was a big step change where now we've got freedom.
Was that difficult, not taking money out? Because I always think about it for my own business. If I wasn't taking money out, I'd always be terrified that something was going to change in the past and I'd missed that window.
Look, the requirements of what we needed was we were so young.
Yeah, okay.
We were so young, we didn't need much. That deal was at 19 years old. You know, we didn't need much. We were making profit already. We probably had what we wanted. We didn't need much. So, no. We were always working some idea of exit at some point. So we just rolled it. And we're just happy with the delayed remuneration.
So how long after the IPO did you guys walk away?
A year.
Okay.
August 2020.
I imagine you made the decision earlier than that, but it took a bit of time to actually get
No.
there.
No.
Was it pretty quick?
Yeah, June. Made the decision in June.
Made the decision in June, you're out by August.
The chairman didn't want us there. We had a year notice, we'd happily done longer, yeah, whatever. But he made the decision.
And did he make that decision after you said, look, we want out?
Yeah.
Or okay,
yeah.
He didn't try and push you out?
No.
Okay.
So, fine. You know, then it's, then it's middle of COVID.
Yeah. A weird time to have all of a sudden time freedom.
I got rid of everything. Money. I got rid of my house, got rid of my car, got rid of all my subscriptions. I remember like the September month, yeah. The only direct debit I had coming out of my bank account was my Netflix subscription.
You kept that one.
Yeah, I needed it. I was living in Spain. My wife's got a place in Spain, so I was living there. So I didn't need anything. It was really like a deep, clean cleanse of life.
And did you enjoy that? The change of pace?
Oh, beautiful. For like 3 weeks.
Okay.
Yes. And then I'm like, okay, what am I doing next? Like, right. Like my imposter syndrome, my like paranoia, my like... I don't know. I didn't know what I'd done was great or good or where I sat in the world, because I had no comparisons. Yeah, I'd never done anything previously. So like I exit, my inbox gets full of people congratulating, and then people are like, oh, what are you doing now? I'm like, I'm going to teach my dog how to sit. So I got, you know, at this point, my dog's like 5 months old. And like, yeah, I'm like,
that's helpful.
I'm like, you're the only person that needs me now.
Yeah.
Like you're the only thing that needs me. sit.
Did it.
Yes. And like, it was a really kind of weird paradox. You've gone from like life being really important and being important to people and to not being important. That was a hit.
Yeah.
Like, emotional hit. I was like, I'm not important to people. And, you know, I think what COVID and what that kind of exit period and all that kind of stuff was teaching me is like what I want to do next. And like, the funny thing is I tried some things in Social Chain to get these, what I'm doing now, off the ground. So I tried to start an academy at Social Chain. That got hit by COVID because we couldn't deliver classes in person. So we pulled the plug on that. We started to invest in some businesses and brands, but we did the marketing.
Yeah.
Obviously didn't, you know, didn't work because of everything, because of not being there. So what I'm doing now and what I'd spend my time doing now is exactly what I would have done in Social Chain.
Okay. Interesting.
It's just, I basically got to the point in the business where we built it up to be a bit of a machine, a bit autonomous, that I could start questioning myself what I want to do.
Mm.
And what I do now is I've got a base camp, which is our training business, and Fearless, which is investing companies.
Yeah.
And we've had the marketing. So I'm doing exactly what I wanted to do. So it was only after realizing I could do anything, sounds stupid, but because I had the freedom and time to do anything in the business.
Yeah.
What did I want to do? I wanted to train the next generation of marketers and help people through, you know, actually giving them proper training. And I wanted to support great small companies with things that they struggle with through services. And that was, the new business was born from that.
How long after, you know, this period of 3 weeks that was nice and relaxed, did you start on that journey?
I did a bit of consulting for a period of time and then realized that was empty and then fell into it, yeah.
You didn't enjoy the consulting?
To a point where you realize you can't implement.
So it's frustrating if they don't take the advice.
Yeah, yeah. Like, you can give all the advice and you can give all the help, but like, yeah, yeah. This is where, this is probably where the Fearless was born from. It's like, you have to be aligned. You have to be in the bed together.
Yeah.
You know, a small company might take it or leave it, but if I put some money into you, invest in you, and we're aligned on the objectives, then you're more likely to take my advice. And if I actually help you then do it by having two or three experts who are growth experts or who are strategists alongside me, then we can implement as well. So consultancy is empty. Consultancy alongside implementation is powerful.
It's close. Consultancy plus implementation is close to agency work.
Yeah. But I'm not doing that again. Whoa.
It's PTSD. What it sounds like to me. Don't say that.
But then the thing is, the big thing I've had about agencies is not sharing the upside. So if you invest, you share the upside.
A different dynamic.
So effectively, you know, it's like having clients that never leave.
Mm.
So you invest in these companies, you help them grow, you implement stuff, but it's not an agency relationship.
Yeah.
It's services, but you're not managing agency, you're not pitching. You're aligned on the outcomes.
What does your, like, a week for you look like now? I was looking on your LinkedIn before this conversation, and you've got investor listed alongside about 856 different companies.
Yeah.
So it seems like things would be very busy. Is that the case?
Yeah. I mean, I hated angel investing. So I hated writing checks to the money and never speaking to them ever again.
Right.
I wanted to be able to help people have impact, but either by a non-exec or by some kind of increased role. Because I had time. Yeah. At that point, I had time and money. So I could do both. You know, I could give you money and I could give you my time. So we started to do that. So me and one of my biggest clients, Social Chain, David Nunes, is my business partner. We started to do that together with a guy called Charlie Yates, who's corporate finance advisor. So he'd look at the deals and we'd decide to do them and we'd do them together. And then from that was born Fearless in terms of investing, helping businesses, not just giving consultancy, but actually then implementing, having people on our own payroll who could do the growth side of things. And then we gave birth to this venture capital, embedded venture capital model. So we've got a portfolio of 8 companies. We're starting more investments and more companies ourselves. We've got a trading business, which was born out of an idea I had to go and do it. So like, look, call it fingers and pies, running companies, helping on growth, managing investors, raising capital, speaking at events, doing podcasts, walking my dog, eating food.
Is that stressful? Why not live a calmer life?
I tried that for 3 weeks. I hated it.
Okay.
The stress is what I like.
Okay.
I remember, I don't know why my wife asked me this, but like, what does success look like? And for some reason, I've always had this view in my mind. Yeah. I don't know why, but it's probably my granddad. Yeah. Sat there in like a really cozy front room with a fire on with kids. And I'm like, I was reading the paper. I'm watching like the rugby on the TV and I'm just stopped. And like, I've got that image on mind.
Okay.
And like, when that image is created, I probably will stop.
Mm.
But I'm not there yet.
Okay.
And like, I'm not there yet because I don't know. But I said, that's what I'm working towards. I'm working towards that moment. I don't know what life looks after that moment, but I'm working towards that moment in my life. And I'm happy just to keep going and keep going until that happens. And it's not happened to me yet. And I want it to happen to me. But I probably will slow down, and when I've got reasons to slow down, but at the moment I haven't.
Have you got any big like goals with what you're doing right now? Is you want a $1 billion portfolio or something along those lines?
I've not got any numbers associated with it. Like I said, I wanted to train 1,000 people. That was kind of one of the metrics. So we're at 500, 600 people now. There's no financial like figure attached to what I want to do. Okay. I don't need a lot. Look, I'd like to go into politics one day.
Really?
There's probably a view in there someday. I think, you know, we've seen it, especially last couple of weeks, how bad it is.
I think a lot of people would agree with you on that.
That's another podcast. But I'd like to go into that.
Okay.
I'm not driven by money at all.
You'd like to go into politics? That seems...
This comes back to the whole point of me liking the stress, yeah?
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I don't know.
Not quite. A fun life.
Got some weird addiction to stress, mate, honestly. I like the problems. I look at problems, I either run away from them or run towards them.
Okay.
And like, I think that the world, the UK could be run better.
Mm.
And like, look, you know, there's a game you've got to play. You've got to figure out an alignment, and you've got to try and infiltrate that situation and move into a situation where you want to be, and it's all a game. I think I could play the game.
Okay. Interesting. So obviously you've been very busy since you left Social Chain. Your previous business partner has as well. Has it surprised you what Steve's been able to do with...
Not one bit.
No.
No, not one bit. Like the guy set his mind to anything, he'll do what he wants to do.
Really?
Yeah. Look, you know, working alongside him, working with him, like he's a force of nature. Like if he wanted to go into politics, if he wanted to go into anything, or he wants to do anything, he'll do it better than anyone.
Why? What does he have that has allowed the Diver CEO to become this absolute Goliath of a show and various other successes that he's had?
Look, timing. You know, he'll sit there and say timing as well. You know, he was very early in podcasting.
Yeah,
but he was also very late in some instances. But he more than I ever will, and it's something I really admire. He sweats the small stuff.
Oh, okay.
Really sweats the small stuff. You know, finite margins, improvements. You know. Every single thing, the level of standard he brings to things is determination. Like it's relentless. Like the guy is in terms of like ambition, in terms of mind, in terms of standards, like beyond anything I've ever seen of anyone.
Interesting.
Like if you put him in a physical athlete, I can only compare it to like some kind of like physical athlete mindset.
Yeah, yeah.
Like his mindset is like unbelievable. And like I say, I know a lot of footballers, I know a lot of sportsmen. They still don't have the level of mindset he has. So he has that real, like, real high quality mindset of standards for everything.
Where do you think he's going then?
Wherever he wants to go. Wherever he wants to go. Look, I think he's not, you know, he's not, you know, he looks at people. I don't have like influences in my life yet. I don't look at people and be like, I want to, but like he, you know, he will be like the UK, like Elon Musk. Like he will
really
continue to do things, and you know, he will continue to do things, invest in spot businesses, and that's where that's the kind of level he wants to go to. You know, no doubt about it. So, he's an entrepreneur first. He's an entrepreneur. So, you know, that world is the world he wants to continue to take on. So everything he's built around it has been a platform for entrepreneurship, and he's an entrepreneur at his heart, and he'll take on big challenges. He'll take on a really big entrepreneurial challenge one day. You know, like, not that he has at the moment, but like you can see by his podcast the things that interest him, like health, you know, wellness. He'll go and take on a really big life problem and he'll solve it.
Wow. Okay. Very interesting. Would you like the level of fame that he's got?
No. I'm very different. Maybe part of me would have done when I was younger, but like, I don't know. I'm very happy. I'm very happy with like, you know, I walked down the street the other day and some guy stopped me and was like, "Dom, I'm ex-paratrooper.
Yeah, yeah.
And I've never met anyone who's given me as much motivation as you. I'm like, I've just been on a date. I'm well annoyed because I had a drink. But you, I'm annoyed because I'm now seeing you and you're making me feel worse about it.
Okay.
And I'm like, I've not done anything. Like, no, but I've not drank for 4 months because of you. You've helped me.
Really?
And now he's like, he had like an epiphany in front of me. This is a great man. Yeah. Big guy. Back to power. He's had an epiphany in front of me that he's just had this first drink in 4 months. He's walked to me down the street and he's like kicking himself. I'm like, this is like, make me feel awkward.
Yeah.
But like for me, like that being able to impact one person's life was always what I wanted to do. And I'm happy just knowing that one person's had a positive impact with me.
But obviously if you had more fame, potentially more people have a positive impact. I suppose you're doing a podcast today. Yeah. So you obviously, like, you have a very interesting things to say and also a message with the drinking stuff that you know is going
to
help.
And I think that's the thing. Like, look, if the bigger platform gives me a more powerful message to be able to reach more people, then that's great.
Mm.
You know, I'll continue to do things like this because I wanted the message to be out there and I want to help people. It's also a message which puts people off me. You know, we've talked about the culture and how it's protected. And me going and me and pushing about drink, you know, it means that a lot of people disagree with me.
Yeah.
And I think I've probably learned, you looked at my LinkedIn, I probably created a bit of a opinion-led thought of how I think things can be better. Maybe the move into politics is part of that or what I want to do in the future. But I don't have all the answers. I never will have all the answers, but I just have my own experience.
Yeah.
And if I can share my own experience and help people through doing that and trying to make the world a little bit of a better place, then... And yeah, I think the move, you know, politics, you know, would come with an elevation piece. You know, I think a lot of people who get fame really young and get thrown into things can't handle it. Mm. I think I've had an exposure to that life and a learning of that life through reaching millions of people on social media anyway, through stuff I've done to know that it's a great tool, it's a great piece, but it's not going to ever be something that if I don't do it, I'm not going to be bothered. If I wake up, you know, and I've continued to be offended to myself and more people engage with that, great. But if I don't and it doesn't happen, I'm happy with the guy I met on the street the other day.
We both mentioned about how bizarre we feel it is, how like ubiquitous alcohol is, combined with you wanting to go into politics. I wanted to ask, have you got thoughts around what could or should be done alcohol-wise? Are there changes you'd like to make to legislation?
The truth is at the moment, like, it's going down the smoking route.
Mm.
Very, very slowly. You know, it's a couple of decades behind it, but it's going on the smoking route.
As in people are choosing to drink less anyway?
People
or you mean
drink
with
less,
rules coming in?
Taxes are increasing.
Yeah, okay.
It's becoming unprofitable.
Yeah, yeah.
For people to sell it. Advertising's been reduced. Marketing's been reduced on it. You know, in 20 years' time, if we've got no alcohol advertising on TV, we've just got zero, that's where it's going to be.
Mm.
Naturally, what I think will happen in the market is you'll get people who are making more profit on alcoholic drinks, yeah, because there's no duty. But a price of zero Guinness is the same as a Guinness now.
Yeah.
So like,
so that's why they're advertising it.
So naturally, there's going to be more margin in alcoholic drinks.
Yeah.
So more businesses will sell them. And what we'll see is alcohol marketing be reduced, that emotional dependency be reduced, young people not drinking. And you know what? It'll be a day where someone says they smoke and you go,
yeah,
you smoke.
Yeah.
Don't like the smell, don't like the taste. And people, and that at the moment, we're in a situation where I say I don't drink, you think I've got a problem. But at one point it'll come say, you'll have to be the one to say I drink and I think you'll have a problem. Same with smoking. Now if someone smokes, you go,
why?
Yeah,
why?
And I think it'll end up there.
Okay, that's interesting. I also wanted to ask you about social media. There are parts of society that feel quite negatively towards social media. What are your thoughts on that?
I hate it.
You hate social media?
I absolutely hate social media. It's part of, you know, why I want to leave is like, I didn't want to be a 30-year-old running a social media company because I was starting to hate the product.
Okay.
So like, I was done with it. You know, TikTok came, I was like, I'm not going on this platform.
Yeah.
So I hate it, I dislike it. I'm not a fan of it.
But obviously a lot of the companies you're involved in, they must be using social media all the time.
I mean, it's like a channel now, isn't it? Look, it's like a newspaper, yeah. It's just now part of it. Mm. It's part of the world we accept it. It's got to be there. We've got to live there. It's not like my focus. So like I can not go on. I don't go on TikTok.
Okay.
Just don't. I get updates from my wife every night on what's happened. She'll be like, I'll show you some funnies. I'm like, okay, thank you. That's my TikTok
some things
time.
That'll make you laugh.
Exactly. Yeah. So like, I try and restrain my own use on it. I try, you know, there's a reason why, you know, big execs in Facebook and stuff don't like use it and don't use it.
Yeah.
So like, it's again, it's part of the addiction.
Are you concerned society-wide?
Oh, yeah, 100%. I'm really concerned about young people coming through now. Part of what, you know, the screen time in general, false information, attention spans, really concerned. Mm. Yeah, like openly concerned about it. Like, you know, the 30-year-olds that are getting into wellness and Pilates and outdoor living, hopefully young people realize that earlier.
Yeah. Okay.
And they start to just turn away and they're like, actually, you know, reconnecting with nature is really nice. Having detoxes is really nice. Not drinking is really nice. And I think maybe what will happen is that, look, you see, like, maybe our parents' generation learned that later in life, you know, we're learning it quicker, you know. Hopefully young people learn it even quicker.
Yeah. Yeah. Because when you see an 11-year-old on a smartphone, he seems to just be glued to it. Oh, okay. Like, especially as people who've worked in that space, you just go, whoa.
Yeah, you go, oh God.
That's tricky. You've talked about going forward in terms of business-related stuff. Obviously, you've written a book as well.
Yeah.
Why did you decide to write a book? That doesn't sound like the easiest thing to do.
No, but again, coming back to the point around the message. Yeah, there's a message out there, and I think the book is also aimed at men. Because men are, look, I wanted to get across that with Jack the Lad. You know, I was a normal guy. I played football. I had beer on a Saturday. I'd go out and have 5 drinks and play football Sunday morning. Like, I was normal. I felt like I was just a middle average guy. People ask me, like, why did your content work on social media? It's like, I just said I was average.
Yeah. Okay.
I understood the world and people, and I lived a normal life. So I think I'm normal in that sense. Maybe I'm not, but, I wanted to get across with that. As I said previously, I was normal and my life changed. A lot of the things that happened were outside of my control. And because I was unable to handle it, it ruined me. Mm. And then I had to regain control. And I think a lot of people don't realize how much life can shift and how quickly life can shift. And I want people to wake up and just think that if my life changes, I want to be able to deal with it rather than let alcohol deal with me or any addiction consume me and make my life worse. Because when you're bad and like things are going wrong or something happens or you have major grief or you have a relationship breakup, it takes a bit of time to rebound.
Yeah.
If you've got an addiction or you're struggling with something, it actually makes it worse. And like, look, that's what, you know, you talk about things like male suicide, that kind of stuff. Like, we shouldn't be in a situation where we should be able to not make things worse for people. And if I can just point out that maybe drinking too much in those situations can have damage long term and you can go down a difficult route, don't. Because I think it will hopefully help people. And, you know, if it saves a life, it saves a life.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll include links, obviously, in description, everything like that.
Yeah.
Was it difficult to go back into thinking about some of those things?
Because of time, it's like 7 years ago, I've got to go back to a place, but you've got to really go back into the place. So yeah, it was very difficult to like be that person again and like really like open the vulnerability and get the vulnerability on words.
Yeah.
You know how people like sometimes write a letter and burn it?
Right, okay.
I wrote a letter and published it.
That's quite a different thing, isn't it?
Yeah, but that's how I feel a little bit. Like, it's in the ether now. You know, my gran read it the other day and, you know, she was like, oh, I didn't realize things were that bad. I'm like, you wouldn't have, gran, because you wouldn't have known. She, you know, she was like, this is great. Like, so it helps people know me without knowing me, and it helps me like help people.
Mm.
And so, yeah, it was great.
Well, well done for writing it. And we were able to go through before this conversation, and like, obviously given what you do, you didn't need to do it. You know, you didn't need to,
it. But again, it always felt like it wasn't for me.
Yeah.
You know, there's no money in books, there's no profit in it, whatever, unless I write Harry Potter or Game of Thrones. So yeah, it's a passion. It's like it's like putting a line in the sand of like, look, this is, you know, people ask me all the time for what should I do? And I can now say, look, I've written a book about what to do. So yeah, it's
resources there.
Yeah, that's how it felt.
Mm. Awesome. Fab, well, Dominic, thank you very much for coming to speak to me. Really appreciate
the
time.
Thank you for having me.
Really enjoyed that conversation. Some great stuff. So yeah, thank you.
Thank you.